I am Brian Vardabedian, a.k.a. Dr. V, and thanks for joining me. It was great having Dr. Andrew Ibrahim in the exam room as part of How I Got Here, a brand new series looking at the career paths of some of medicine's most fascinating figures. As an academic surgeon at the University of Michigan and trained architect, Dr. Ibrahim epitomizes the alternate career track. And in this episode, we explored his earliest interest in design and the steps that led to his role as a physician at one of the largest architectural firms in the world. You'll be struck by both his humility as well as his vision for a future where systematic design will make schools, office spaces, and even sports stadiums, as you'll learn, healthier. If you want to see the future of healthcare, ride this episode to the end and listen between the lines. I hope you enjoy this edition of How I Got Here in the Exam Room. Dr. Andrew Ibrahim, welcome to the exam room, and thank you for being part of our special series, How I Got Here.
Thanks so much, Brian. Thanks for having me.
And honestly, I don't know how long I've been kind of emailing you. We've been trying to get you on the show here for the longest time, haven't we?
True story. But the story's better than it was a year ago, so I'm glad we waited.
Right, exactly. Part of our series here is to try to have conversations with some really interesting docs who are doing some really interesting things, and you came to mind, and you have a very, very interesting story or background or professional trajectory. So maybe you could tell us a little bit about what you do.
Sure. So I am formerly trained in general surgery, and this year I'll be incoming faculty in the Department of Surgery at the University of Michigan. And I also, before medical school, studied architecture. And at various points, gotten back into architecture. So I also have a joint appointment in the Taubman College of Architecture and Urban Planning. And then in parallel to all of that, I'm also the chief medical officer at HOK and a senior principal there, which is a global design, architecture, and engineering firm in about 23 cities and three continents.
So Andrew, you really call yourself a surgeon as opposed to an architect, right? I mean, how do you identify? What's your...
Yeah, I think surgery is without question, my primary identity, and that's where I spend most of my time and how I see myself. And then my role in architecture seems to be growing every few months, but I'm not formally licensed as an architect, so I can't practice that independently. But it is certainly get to influence the practice a lot working in a large firm.
HOK is one of the top five architectural firms in the world. And how did it turn out that this massive architectural firm found you and wanted you on board as their chief medical officer? Walk us through that.
Yeah, great question. I'll backtrack a little bit and just give a little context. And I am my like earliest memory of myself as like a little kid, probably as early as third or fourth grade, was finishing my homework as quick as I could, turning it over so I'd have a blank sheet of paper, and I would start drawing cities and laying them out and figuring out, you know, like, where should the schools be? How many police departments do you need? How big should a block be? And how close should residential be to commercial industry? And there was sort of like this itch there that I always tried to scratch longitudinally throughout my life. When I got to college, I was pretty set on going to medical school and was like the type A pre-med that I think a lot of us were. Did the summer OChem classes and the physics, and I think I got into med school when I was about 20. And it was kind of weird to go shadow at the medical school for a day, knowing I wasn't even old enough to like drink a beer legally. And I'm thinking like, I'm not ready for this. So I went to the dean of the medical school and I said, you know, I'm so thrilled to have this opportunity, but like, I'm just not ready. And she like very thoughtfully asked, she's like, well, what would you do if you weren't a doctor? And I was like, I'd be an architect. She's like, you answered that pretty quickly. And I said, yeah. Oh, well, it's just, you know, I just had this itch. And she said, well, why don't you do something in architecture? And if you love it, stay there. And if it's not what you want, we'll hold your spot to come back and start medical school. So I moved to London and studied architecture and planning at the Bartlett. And did the foundation coursework there. And I didn't see myself having a real future in architecture, but I liked a lot of the questions they were asking and the ideas of planning out cities, managing competing stakeholders, thinking about city codes and materials and planning. And I thought, what a valuable set of skills to bring back to medicine. So I like very naively and excited showed up to the medical school and I said, you know, who are the architects that work in the medical school who can help me think about regional planning of healthcare, access to care, and all these questions? And I think people kind of laughed a little bit. And I was just so confused. And I was like, they're like, there are no architects here. And I was like, really? Like, they don't teach that in medical school? And for some reason,
you weren't in med school at this point, right? You
were still, I was like just starting. Yeah, I was like just starting back from my time. And just came back from architecture time in London and came to medical school and tried to figure out, so like, who are the architect planner people? So I went through medical school kind of thinking about all these questions, kept the note card in my pocket of all the design challenges I thought I'd see just walking around. And fast forward a few years, I'm halfway through surgical training and I get a Robert Wood Johnson Clinical Scholars Fellowship, which is basically a two-year fellowship designed to really do professional development. And they're like, what do you want to do? And I was like, well, I spent time working in health policy, thinking about like access to care and delivery and regional planning.
Can I interrupt you at this point and ask you, up until this point, so you'd express some interest as an early medical student, had you done anything between starting medical school and halfway through surgical residency beyond keeping notes and having thoughts and fantasies?
No, it honestly was sort of hibernated. Uh-huh. I had never, at that point, if you asked me, I said architecture would have been a like second career when I feel burned out from medicine or something, and I'll get to it when I'm in like my 60s. But I'd never really envisioned it as a deliberate integration into my professional life much earlier. So I got this fellowship and they said, well, what do you want to do? And I articulated like a very traditional academic surgery vision. Mm-hmm. And they said, you know, we already have a lot of people who do that. And I was like, well, that's what I want to do. And they're like, well, what would you do if you weren't a doctor? And I was like, oh, I'd be an architect. And they were
heard
like,
the question before.
They're like, you've answered that quickly. And I was like, well, it's not the first time I've had to think about it. And they said, well, why don't you why don't you reach out to major architecture firms, find out who the clinicians are that work in those firms, and see if you can recruit one or two of them as a mentor to sort of help you think about how some of those interests that you clearly have had longitudinally might work their way into your kind of traditional academic surgery career. And I remember just reaching out to all the major firms, and I probably reached out to all the top 20 firms, and just very, again, naively was like, you know, I know you guys are the major firms who do multi-billion dollar healthcare projects. Just wanted to know, like, who is the physician or clinician who works in your practice that I could talk to help with some research ideas and kind of have as a mentor? And almost universally, everyone said, like, we don't have that kind of a person. And I said, you mean when you're doing these huge, large public infrastructure projects, these large healthcare delivery projects, there's no one on your side of the table who understands day-to-day clinical practice, who understands the incentives of the Affordable Care Act, who understands how to interpret high-level healthcare research that everyone in healthcare is using to make large decisions? And they said, no. And I said, don't you think that would be valuable? And they said, of course. And I said, well, how valuable exactly? Because I was trying to get a sense of like, is this a real career trajectory? And is there like a market demand for that kind of a person? Like, is this just like my little interest as like someone and it's like a hobby? Or is this like, oh my gosh, this is a real professional trajectory that needs formal development? So I reached out to many firms and talked to a lot of them about the idea of creating a position. And I ended up joining HOK in large part because I felt like they aligned most with my vision of trying to integrate some of the great things that we do in healthcare, including scientific research, commitment to quality improvement, a lot of the things that we probably take for granted that are just normative in our culture now. How willing a firm would be to embrace those ideas and attitudes and give me some freedom to try to integrate those into practice. So there are a number of great firms for sure in the world. And I think HOK and I just saw eye to eye the best and ended up joining them there.
So this is during your Rob Ward Johnson Foundation Fellowship during surgical training, right?
Yes, it's just towards the end of it. In that time, while I was exploring kind of all of these different firms, I ended up being appointed to the American Institute of Architects Design and Health Leadership Group, which is basically a group of about 20 thought leaders appointed by the American Institute of Architects to try to make more deliberate connections between health and design. And I was sort of like the token clinician in the group. And what I sort of realized, you know, we had some really thoughtful discussions. We wrote guidelines. We developed all these theoretical models. We identified what we thought were key research priorities. And I thought like, oh man, like this is really great. Like this is really going to start building these connections. But one of the projects, you know, they asked us to do was we built all these guidelines. We disseminated all these things and people weren't really adopting them. So we ended up going into firms and practices and interviewed people who are actually practitioners in architecture and urban planning and said, like, do you think health and design is important? They're like, for sure. Like, do you think your clients would want a more healthier version of whatever you're designing? They're like, totally. We're like, so why aren't you using any of the things that we've outlined and described and whatever? And they then just enumerated a number of constraints, competing interests, challenges as to why integrating health into design wasn't easily implementable. So it wasn't
embraced initially, eh?
No, it wasn't embraced. And I think it wasn't for lack of interest. I think it was in part for lack of ability.
Fear?
Some fear. It's something new. Are clients really going to want this? Is this really going to be something that we can bill for? Is this just like an idea or does this have like some real legs to it? And I think what I took away from that was that if I really wanted to advance this idea, I sort of had to be in the trenches and sort of doing the work. And that's what really led me to joining an architecture firm. I think it would be really similar to, I think we see this in healthcare a lot. There are a lot of people who talk about ways to deliver healthcare better. And I think a lot of them are very effective. But I think some of the people who are most effective also still have a hand in clinical care, are still seeing patients, are still understanding the day-to-day realities of what it means to work in a clinic or a hospital or to see patients. And so I think it occurred to me that the same was true for architecture, and that if I didn't have my hand involved in real projects, talking to clients, understanding all the constraints of architecture, I wouldn't really be in a good position to try to bring the two fields together.
So currently, tell us a little bit about what you do with HOK. What do you do in your day-to-day work? Is it sort of touch and go? Is it project-based? How does that work?
Yeah, it works in a couple different domains. I think when I originally got there, my slightly Pollyanna pipe dream was that, you know, I'm going to go there. I'm going to have all these great research tools of healthcare. And I'm just going to like implement them into the firm. And in 6 months, we're going to have like a health services research division within an architecture firm. And very quickly, I realized the reality of most architecture firms is that standardization of these questions and measurement was almost like non-existent. So just as an example, one of my first questions in the firm was, what is the average size of an operating room that we build? We have a number of clients. We've built dozens of hospitals in the last decade. We certainly should know like what our normative parameters are of something as objective as the size of an OR. And it actually wasn't a readily answerable question.
Wow.
And part of it was that our different medical planners in different cities and different parts of the world labeled operating rooms differently in their models. Some people would call it like OR underscore number. Some people would call it, you know, the number and then backslash the OR and whatever. And you sort of realize that like just to aggregate the data across our firm to answer a simple question of square footage of an OR was super challenging. We didn't even have agreed upon terms or definitions. And so then it became the case of like, all right, we needed to create some standardized definitions, some standardized questions that we think are important. And I think the recurring theme that'll probably come up is I thought I had a good idea of like what the important questions were. But I think until you're in the room with a client trying to think through a real project, it's really hard to be well informed about what the right questions to ask are. So for the last year and a half or so, I've really focused on trying to get integrated into healthcare delivery projects. So I can't speak about the specific projects themselves, but I can describe them in general. One is master planning of a large academic health center on the scale of like a $1 to $2 billion master plan of what do we build, where do we build it, how much do we need, and how does that fit into the overall strategy of the health system. So that's like one domain of project. There's another project that involves actually like office space work and this idea that an employer actually pays for the health insurance of their employees. And is there anything about an actual office building that an employer can do to make the building healthier that aligns with their strategy to save on healthcare costs for their employees? Fascinating question, and certainly starts to bridge a lot of the expertise of healthcare, policy incentives, and actually architecture and built design. And then the third project that I'm excited about that isn't a actual project, but is a prototype, is we've talked about designing a healthy stadium. And the idea is that a stadium is a huge, large public infrastructure investment that we maybe use 12 times a year. And the question is, if it is a public resource, and it does take a lot of public money, is there a way you could design this building differently, where instead it's seen as almost a giant Central Park that's used 7 days a week by the public, available for physical activity, places for people to gather and socialize, and a place for people to learn healthy habits? It all of a sudden sort of redefines what that building could be, and almost thinking of that building as a public health intervention almost. So those are the three kind of domains of projects I've been working on that have been fascinating. And I'm just learning a ton about where are the right places where health should say some more about design, and maybe where are some places that we should probably back off and leave it alone.
Let's get into design and health in just a second, but I want to finish this little question with the understanding if you still do surgery, or is that something you're doing? I mean, what percentage of your time is spent in clinical care?
Yeah, so I'm still predominantly a clinical surgeon, and my time at HOK is less than a half day a week. Over the next year, that'll scale up to probably almost a full day a week in HOK, down to about 1 or 1.5 days of operating time, and then having the rest of the time for research and a fellowship that we're about to launch.
Can I go back just a little bit to your earliest interests? And you mentioned both. You've mentioned planning quite a bit. You've mentioned design. What was your primary motivation when you were that first year of medical school, or when you were starting to explore this with the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation? Were you really more interested in planning and system planning, or was it really true design thinking that fascinated you?
Yeah, I think it was probably more on the planning side. You know, one of my most memorable courses in London involved one of the professors taking you on a walk around London. And, you know, they would do this routine where they'd say like, hey, Brian, why don't we just stop here? Tell me what you think of this building. And, you know, you're in zone one London. You're like, it's beautiful. They're like, yeah, but like, you know, take a look at it. And they'd start critiquing it. And they'd say like, you know, like the windows aren't evenly spaced. It doesn't even fit in with the rest of the street. And, you know, the door doesn't even match the rest of the building. And they sort of start pointing out all these design things to you. And then you sort of say, like, you know, now that you mention it, and you would just rattle off 20 minutes of critiques before realizing it was that person's building. And as you went through that, then the person responded and they said, I don't disagree with your critiques, but you don't know all the other competing challenges and interesting codes that I had to adhere to. The city code required that I had to do this size, this number of feet away from the curb. The local community requested that a certain percent of materials had to be locally sourced, which changed why we use this and this. The reason the windows aren't evenly spaced is because they were pre-existing load-bearing pillars that we couldn't move. And the only way to accommodate those was to change our window. And all of a sudden, like, I thought that was just like genius. Like the ability to negotiate multiple stakeholders and interest and still and still be able to pull off a project. Like I could imagine many people being like, screw it, with that many challenges, like we're not gonna do this project. And I thought that the better answer was, let's still do this project and figure out how to accommodate all these different challenges. So I think like that mindset is what got me really excited. And what going into medical school, you know, when I started medical school, the Affordable Care Act had not passed yet. And so we were talking about universal healthcare, and people would have the same conversations. Well, how much resources would you use? Where would you locate it? And to me, it was like the same framework and challenge of trying to negotiate all these competing stakeholders and interest. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's what really resonated with me.
Let's jump on that third project, which really centers on using or creating a stadium that has multiple sort of maybe purposes or objectives. Mm-hmm. You know, when I think about a building, I guess Winston Churchill said that we create our buildings and our buildings in turn shape us. So I guess it sort of follows on that, right? Mm-hmm. I've always thought a building is a space that I go in and I sort of adapt to it. And you're suggesting that really architecture and planning and design should really be systematically committed to health, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of a core tenet of your mantra, right?
Yeah, for sure. So I one of the things I learned now being in practice and being in these meetings for a couple of years is that there are a lot of good ideas to implement into a project. And the earlier they can be introduced into the planning, the easier they are to integrate. So if you go into a project that's been built for a year and say, gosh, I wish we added these health elements to it, it's really hard to retroactively change a right. building that's already occupied. But if you say from the first time you sit at the drawing board, look, I know there are a number of priorities in this project. There's maybe 10 that are serious. I'm not saying that health needs to be your first priority, but I want health to be in your top handful. And I think what I've learned, you know, HRK's practice, only 20 or 25% of it is healthcare. The rest of it is hotels and stadiums, office buildings, campuses. Mm-hmm. And I learned in spending those meetings that if you could introduce an idea early, it is much easier to integrate a couple of common sense ideas early on that can keep their way through the life of the project. And so I've tried to advocate that should we just see everything we build and design as an opportunity to improve health? And if there isn't just one or two things in a project that we could think about upfront at the beginning that would have a positive impact on the health of people who occupy that space.
Putting nudges into the design, right? Nudging people yep. to take the stairs instead of the escalator, that sort of thing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So I want to chase this point that you made about remaining in clinical practice. I talked to a lot of chief medical officers of startups and major corporations, and I'm with you in that I've found that the sharpest ones do at least a half day or a day of clinic a week. I tell you, these docs who are out of it for 5 years and you try to talk to them about the challenges that we're facing with EHR design, you get the deer in the headlights because it's changing so quickly.
Yeah. I totally agree. So I, you know, my Robert Wood Johnson 2-year fellowship, the first year is a very intensive master's degree in like econometrics and how to handle big data and how to model things. And I loved it, but it is like all in immersive and you kind of got to be there. And so my clinical time cut down there to like less than half day a week. Mm-hmm. And there were some times where I'd go 2 weeks without being in a clinical environment. And I'll tell you, after that year, even just 1 year of being scaled back to almost nothing, just 1 year, when I went back in the hospital,
right.
there were just some things I didn't even recognize.
Yep.
And I was like, oh, I didn't know we do that. Like, we've been doing that for 6 months. It's old news. And I was like,
right. Oh. You get irrelevant really fast.
Yeah. yeah. So that definitely was a lasting lesson.
I want to talk a little bit about visual abstracts. And for unless the listeners have been living under a rock, the format of delivering research abstracts really has undergone a substantial shift that I think began in 2016. And who started that?
Annals of Surgery is one of our flagship journals, probably the most cited journal in the country, in the world, really, for academic surgery, right up there at JAMA Surgery. And they reached out to me to take over their social media account, in part because I think a lot of their editorial board just was not very keen to social media. Mm-hmm. And as a willing young surgeon in the making, I said, yeah, of course. And they gave me this paper to, they gave me kind of access to the whole account. And I tweeted out this paper that I thought was just genius. And I think, man, I have access to social media account. Like, everyone's going to read this paper. And like, nobody clicked on the link. And I just remember being like, so confused. And I was like, but the content right. of this is so good. So I almost inadvertently sort of channeled my architecture design side, because, you know, in architecture and design, the whole, so much of the value is being able to communicate your work visually. So I tried to communicate the key essence of that research paper visually, and what I later called a visual abstract, which was the visual summary of the key points of the paper. And so in that July of 2016, we launched the first visual abstract at Annals of Surgery. And within 2 weeks, it got seen like 30,000 times.
That's amazing.
And I thought, oh my gosh, this is like a real way to disseminate it. So I think one of the key mentoring moments I had there, though, is I told my mentor, I was like, we're like onto something. Like, I got to present this to the Annals of Surgery board. So I presented it to him, and there were sort of two camps. There was one camp of people who was like, this is genius. We're going to make this proprietary to Annals of Surgery so that we could get the best article sent to us, and this will be part of our competitive advantage. And there was another camp of people who said, like, this is actually good for everybody, and frankly, we should make this open sourced and available. So I'm thankful that the majority of people, including my mentor, Justin Dimmick, voted for the latter and basically said, why don't you just open source the idea and let people adopt it and modify it and take it on as they could. So as of a few weeks ago, we're well over 100 journals who've adopted the visual abstract and use it in their dissemination strategy for key research articles. I've passed on the baton at Annals of Surgery to a couple young up-and-coming surgeons who are brilliant. And then I joined the editorial board at JAMA and the JAMA network to try doing visual abstract work there.
So why are physicians so absolutely miserable when it comes to design? And the good example is you can go to any medical meeting, a meeting, and you look at the visuals, be it PowerPoint or keynote slides, they're absolutely miserable. I mean, there's something missing in the way that we communicate and translate information, and communication is so critical to what we do. What was so brilliant about what you did with virtual abstracts was that it sort of introduced for the first time design and communication, right?
Mm-hmm. I think there's no question that if you work in healthcare, you would agree that a lot of the people you work with are super brilliant, smart people.
Yep.
And I think if you work in an architecture design firm and you spend time with those people, you also agree that these are like smart, brilliant people. And you start to think like, what is the deal of like why this is a group of really smart people in both groups who aren't seeing eye to eye on this? And I think part of it is the way that we get trained and acculturated to what's important or valuable. So I remember in my like early time at Michigan, someone seeing one of my slide decks and saying, it's not that your content isn't good, but it doesn't look rigorous enough to me unless you put more tables and more words. You know, it's like,
yeah, it's like, you need more junk in there. You need more stuff.
Like, you need more stuff just for like the like illusion of rigor.
Right.
And I kind of chuckled and I said, like, but you got like the key message of the work. And that's like what's most important to me, not like how it looks to you. And so I realized like we probably have a cultural bias in academic medicine about what we think looks more scientific and what we think looks more rigorous and what we perceive as more objective. And I think in the architecture and design world, the bias is like totally the other way, that like, unless you're clear and lucid, it's not like right. it's not meaningful unless it's like totally succinct and makes total sense. So there's definitely a middle ground there that I've been trying to find.
So I think design thinking is going to be one of the core pivotal elements of medicine going forward. And I think the work that you're doing and Bonku and others are kind of setting the stage for how we need to be using design thinking, be it editorial design, you know, editorial design or data design or stadium and hospital design. I think just it's amazing what you've done, Andrew.
Thanks so much. I really appreciate it. I love Bon too. Bon is a good friend, and he's also been an awesome source of inspiration, encouragement to try to bring these two fields together as well.
He is going to be one of our guests on How I Got Here. So we're excited about that.
Oh, brilliant.
So let me ask you about how medicine's culture has accepted you as an architect physician. Obviously, Justin Dimmick's been an amazing mentor for you. Have you had pushback? Have you, just like that person who commented on your slides, have you got pushback from people when you suggest that we need to do things differently?
Yeah, I think one of the lessons I learned from Justin Dimmick, my mentor, he likes to quote Nietzsche's Three Metamorphoses, where he describes their first phase of being a camel, where you kind of wander the desert and you kind of just master all of the things that are known and true. And in your second phase, you become a lion, where you kind of just rip all those conventions apart. And in your third phase, you become like a child, where you get to think anew and be creative and start from scratch and do something novel. And when I showed up, I think early at Michigan, Justin recognized very quickly, he goes, in your mind, you're ready to be a child, but you haven't been a camel or a lion yet. Uh-huh. And what I learned is the reason I was able to get some traction and credibility within the academic community is because I also had 60 academic research papers, and I also published in our top journals in our field, and I did the master's degree in health services research, and I knew how to master a lot of the things that were tried and true. And so it was a little harder to push back against my newer ideas when I had already demonstrated that I knew how to handle some of the things that were already being done. And so I think one of the maybe lessons to maybe some future aspiring design health people is that it's really hard, I think, to, well, let me rephrase. I think it's easier to get traction on a new and novel idea if you're able to say that you've also gone through some of the tried and trues, and that you've gone through some of the things that other people are doing now, to sort of give them some sense that you're not just ignoring or skipping over all the things that they value. Mm-hmm. And so I think
credibility in a way.
Yeah. And so I think sort of putting in a lot of the elbow grease time of learning your past was super important to be able to push back on critics a little bit and say, no, I hear what you're saying. And I've written a bunch of papers that do that, but let me explain to you why I thought this alternative was reasonable.
I'll put in a plug for Justin Dimmick, your mentor. I've always suggested that the leaders of the future will know how to understand and leverage new media tools like Twitter and other platforms. And I love listening to him, and he's a great curator, and he kind of epitomizes that leader who really understands these tools. And when you look at so many academic leaders who disparage Twitter and disparage public profiles, this is where the future is. It's got to be part of our professional responsibility. And I think you're very lucky to have his support and his mentorship.
Yeah, I think he is a once-in-a-generation mentor. He's a true outlier.
Young guy too, right?
Yeah, he's just in his early 40s, I think. So we are lucky that we hopefully have him around for a long time.
So Andrew, what advice would you have for the next generation of surgeons or physicians in general who are either looking to get into design or maybe want to take a non-traditional track? And you've offered some great advice about sort of getting credibility with some of the core stuff, but would you leave some of the younger folks with some advice?
Yeah. So I think I've thought a lot about this. because I had the conversation so many times with mentors and friends. And I'll maybe just steal some more Justin Dimmick advice. He kind of, the mental model he would frame it as is to almost think of it as a stock portfolio, where there's going to be some things that are mutual funds that are kind of your tried and true bread and butter that are always going to be needed and useful. And so for me, that's like clinical surgery work. There's no question that a decade or two decades from now, we're going to need surgeons who can do general surgery. And so protecting that and cultivating that was always important to me. And what that does, though, is if you can master that thing, it then frees up some time for you to be a little more creative in some higher stakes work. I think there's no firm 5 years ago that said, we're looking to create a chief medical officer position in a surgeon trained in health services research who's done some time in London in design. If you meet these criteria, like, please come to our firm and interview. Like, nobody was saying that. And so I think it's worth, after you've sort of shored up your clinical mastery, to think about like where your discretionary interest that you want to develop, and then to slowly start find ways to integrate into that field and learn their pressure points, learn their needs, and start to think, is there a way that I can be valuable to their mission? I think it would be wrong to go into it and say, how can I become the next chief medical officer at whatever organization or whatever field? I think the better question that'll get you a lot further is to think, are there things that I know how to do or that I'm interested in that can help move that way, that field forward in a way that it isn't going now? And do I know enough about that field to understand why that hasn't been done yet? And so I think small interval steps can kind of gradually get you into that.
Amazing advice. And I, you know, that point about the firms not even envisioning a chief medical officer raises this point that medicine is changing so quickly, and everything we understand about where we're going to be 5 years from now is going to be completely different. When Eric Topol gave the commencement address here at Baylor College of Medicine 4 years ago or so, one of the admissions committee asked him, what would you look for in an applicant to our medical school going forward? What's the one characteristic or skill? And he said flexibility. And so,
love it.
You know, keeping your eyes open and being able to change and move with the times is really critical as well.
I love it.
So you have a health and design fellowship, right? That would be a great place for people to sort of figure this out too, right?
Start exploring that a little bit. Yeah. So I think one of the needs I saw working in architecture practice is, you know, there's certainly a lot of programs now where we've started to train people in healthcare in design ideas and design thinking. And I think that's going to get more momentum, and that's important. I think Bon Ku is a great example of someone who's been able to take the design principles and literacy and embed them right into a medical school, which is incredible. I mean, he has a whole cohort of medical students who get like a minor in design, which is incredible. And so what I realized being in practice in architecture in a firm is that there's actually a huge appetite for people in architecture, design, and planning to understand healthcare in a deep and meaningful way. And one of the ways that would be is not just, you know, shadowing in the hospital a few days or doing some healthcare design projects, but actually like formal training. So we at Michigan have had a long history for three decades of a National Clinician Scholar Program, formerly the Robert Wood Johnson Clinical Scholars Program that I did, that basically identified early career physicians who they thought were going to be leaders in the field and train them in health services research. So the ability to do high impact research, ability to handle big data analytics, ability to work in econometrics, ability to lead and organize teams. And most of the people who've done that training go on to either leaders in public service, go on to lead major organizations, go on to be major thought leaders who can do the multi-million dollar NIH grants and be competitive in research at the highest level. And I thought, like, there are so many more people who influence health than just physicians who would benefit from this training. And so a couple of years ago, the net started to widen to nursing and to pharmacy and to social work. And as I sort of started gathering all my experience in architecture, I said, is there any reason why we shouldn't have an architect or an urban planner or a designer right in this cohort as well, who get the same rigorous training that we're giving all of our clinicians to be leaders in care, but give it to people who think through a totally different lens that may have just as much or more impact on the way we deliver medicine. So this will be the first year that we start it. It's called the Health and Design Fellowship at the University of Michigan. I will be sort of the primary director and mentor of it. But there are some key features of it that I'm super excited about. One is that you do get some real formal training in some of the camel and the lion stuff of the metamorphoses of like some real backbone of what it means to do high level research and evaluation in healthcare in the same language and culture and way that people in healthcare are thinking about it. Two, it's entirely funded for the whole 2 years, which means that when you come here, you have a salary and a stipend, and that you have total freedom to work anywhere across the campus. So if you come during that time and decide, you know, I really want to develop expertise in some of this material science or in public policy or in econometrics delivery, you will be able to go to any of those people on campus and work for them at your discretion because you're already paid for. You're free to them and you already have a salary and your time is protected. So that really opens a lot of doors to be creative about how to advance your skill set. And then third, which is a theme that we've talked about multiple times, we've protected about a half day a week for the fellow to stay active in architecture practice. So they can still work in their firm, they can still learn, they can still be involved in projects so that they stay abreast of what are the tensions and constraints in architecture and planning, and how can they bring that back into their fellowship time to think about ways to move that field forward.
Wow. And so this kicks in this summer or next summer?
They will start July 1st. So applications are due April 1st in about just over a week. The application is straightforward. It's just your CV and a one-page personal statement why you want to do it. We'll select them by about the third week of April, and they would start in July of this year.
So, Andrew, how can people find out about the Health and Design Fellowship at the University of Michigan and find out about what you do and what you've done, visual abstracts and more?
Sure. All of it is linked through my website on surgeryredesign.com. And there's a tab there for the fellowship specifically. And then all of my work is on there. And then similar to you, I try to keep my Twitter page pretty active and kind of keep things of what is going on in a pretty judicious, curated way. So either Twitter or the website are two great places to keep a track of the information.
What a great conversation. And I'm glad we were able to get together.
Yeah, this is really fun.
Dr. Andrew Ibrahim, thank you for joining me in the exam room as part of our series, How I Got Here. Your drive to see the world and the work of a physician differently is really creating new paths for those of us all to follow. And I think you're rising as one of the great leaders in medicine going forward. And I consider it a real honor to have you in the exam room, and we hope to have you back.
Awesome, Brian. I look forward to it so much. I really appreciate your time and interest in cultivating this work, because I think a whole generation behind us need to see all the creative ways that we can do it. So I'm excited to listen to your other guests and learn from them and figure out how they've been able to do it as well.
Yes, I'll keep you updated. Thanks, man.
Very good. Thanks.
Thank you for joining us in the exam room. If you like what you heard here, please rate the program, review us, or let folks know about us. And if you have any really cool ideas that you'd like discussed here, please feel free to let us know. This has been a Touchpoint Media production. To learn more about this show and others like it, please visit us online at touchpoint.health.